Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are doing something a little different today. Usually when we talk about, shifting the landscape, we're talking about a war or some piece of tech or a big political movement.
Right.
But today we are looking at a stack of notes about a play.
And not just any play. We are looking at a theatrical marathon.
Literally. We're talking about a four-hour endurance test for the actors and the audience that somehow became the toast of Broadway.
It really is a behemoth.
Mm.
We're discussing Harvey Fierstein's Torch Song Trilogy. And while play is the technical term, it feels bigger. It's more of a cultural event.
Right.
It's a work that took the very specific kind of gritty reality of gay life in late 70s New York and just forced the mainstream to look it right in the eye.
And look at it for 4 hours straight.
Exactly. It demanded your attention.
So here's the mission for this deep dive. We've got production histories, we have critical reviews from 82 all the way up to the 2017 revival, and we have character breakdowns.
A lot to unpack.
A ton. And we're going to try and figure out how a story about a gravel-voiced Jewish drag queen became this strange bridge between conservative family values and radical queer representation.
It's a massive paradox, isn't it? And
yeah.
That's what makes it so fascinating.
Okay, so before we get into the heavy stuff, let's just define the terms, the title. Torch Song Trilogy. Torch Song.
That's not just a poetic phrase. It's a specific thing.
It is, yeah. If you go back to the source, a torch song is a sentimental love song. But specifically, it's about unrequited love. It's about carrying a torch for someone who either doesn't know you exist, or worse, knows you exist and just doesn't care.
So think Judy Garland at 3 a.m.
That is the perfect image. It's melancholic. It's usually solo. And it's basically a musical complaint. I love him. He doesn't love me. Woe is me.
Which, when you look at the protagonist of this play, is kind of his entire personality.
It is the DNA of the show. The main character, Arnold Beckoff, is a professional drag queen who sings these songs. But really, his whole life is one long spoken word torch song. So let's unpack the structure, because that's part of why this thing was such a beast to produce. It's called a trilogy because it's literally three separate plays just glued together.
Yes. And they were originally written and performed separately. You have Act One, which is International Stud. Act Two is Fugue in a Nursery. And then Act Three is Widows and Children First.
And the thread tying it all together is Arnold. The notes here describe him as a kvetch of great wit and want.
That's Fierstein's own description, right in the stage directions. And for anyone who didn't grow up with Yiddish, a kvetch is, a chronic complainer.
Right.
But Arnold isn't just whining. I mean, he's a Jewish homosexual drag queen in New York City in the late 70s. He has a lot to complain about.
And the play opens with him talking directly to the audience.
Right.
It breaks the fourth wall immediately.
He's sitting there putting his makeup on, getting ready for a show, and he delivers this whole soliloquy about his cynical disillusionment with love. He tells us right out of the gate, "I have taught myself to stitch it together, but I still want it." He's a romantic trapped in a cynic's body.
Okay, so let's dive into Act One, International Stud. Now, I just assumed this was a cheeky name for a fictional bar, but the research shows this was a real place.
Oh, very real. The International Stud was a gay bar on Perry Street in Greenwich Village. And it wasn't some, glitzy disco. It was known for its back room.
Which, for the uninitiated, implies anonymous sex.
Correct. It was a space for cruising. And that setting is so important because it immediately establishes the isolation Arnold feels. He's looking for romance in a place that's built for anonymity. And this is where he meets Ed Rice.
So Ed is the International Stud.
Well, Ed is the heartbreaker. He's described as 35, very handsome, and bisexual. And that last part is really the friction point. Ed is deeply uncomfortable with his own sexuality. He likes Arnold. He has a relationship with Arnold. But ultimately, he can't handle it. And he leaves Arnold to be with a woman named Laurel.
And there it is, the torch song theme. He loves the guy who can't or won't love him back fully.
And the play makes this literal. Between the dramatic scenes in Act One, you have this character. She's literally just called Lady Blues.
Oh, cool.
She's a singer dressed in like 20s or 30s period style. And she's just singing these absolutely devastating songs of heartbreak.
So she's basically the soundtrack to Arnold's misery.
She's the emotional narrator. While Arnold is getting dumped, she's in the background singing in the style of like Ruth Etting or Helen Morgan.
Yeah.
It elevates this messy breakup into something almost operatic.
That is such a cool device. It really keeps you in that melancholic headspace.
It does. It reminds you, this isn't just a story about a bad date. It's a story about a very specific kind of loneliness.
Okay, so Act One ends, Arnold's alone. standard operating procedure. Then we hit Act Two, fugue in a nursery. This is a year later. And I have to say, the premise of this act sounds like an absolute nightmare.
It is the definition of it's complicated. So Arnold has found a new lover, a young model named Alan.
Okay, good for him. Fine.
But, and this is the key, Arnold decides that he and Alan should go visit Ed, his ex, and Ed's new girlfriend, Laurel, at their country house for the weekend.
Who does that? Why? Hey, let's go spend a weekend with the guy who broke my heart and the woman he left me for.
It's so messy, right? But the messiness is the point. The title, Fugue in a Nursery, is really clever.
How so?
In music, a fugue is a composition where one melody is introduced and then it's picked up by other parts and they all start weaving in and out of each other.
So it's repetitive and overlapping?
Exactly. And the dialogue in this act literally overlaps. You have these two couples often staged in this one giant surreal bed, and their conversations just weave in and out. It totally reflects the confusion of their relationships.
It sounds like a recipe for a disaster.
It is.
Yeah.
And by the end of the act, the lines are drawn. Laurel tells Arnold that she and Ed are engaged. So the door on Ed is officially slammed shut. So it seems.
But this is where things get really interesting, because up to this point, it's been a relationship dramedy. Act three just changes the entire game.
Act three, Widows and Children First, is where the play gains its real weight. We jump forward several years.
And Arnold isn't just looking for a boyfriend anymore, is he?
No. We find him in a completely different stage of life. He's putting down roots. He's in the process of adopting a child.
A drag queen adopting a kid in the early 1980s. I mean, that must have been just unheard of.
In media, certainly. He's fostering a gay 15-year-old named David. Arnold is trying to be the parent he never had, but there's a massive gaping hole in this picture.
Alan, where's Alan?
Exactly. The young boyfriend from Act Two.
I was wondering, did they break up?
No. And this is the gut punch of the entire trilogy. We find out that just before they were set to officially get David, Alan was killed.
Oh.
He was beaten to death by a group of boys with baseball bats, a homophobic hate crime.
Wow. That takes the play from relationship drama to something so much darker so fast.
What?
It grounds the entire story in the lethal reality of that time. So now you have Arnold, a widower in all but legal standing, raising this traumatized teenager. And then two people show up to complicate his grief. First, Ed is back.
Of course he is.
He's separated from Laurel. He's sleeping on Arnold's couch. But the real antagonist arrives from Florida, Mrs. Beckoff. Ma. She is the final boss of the trilogy.
The notes describe her as strict, traditional, very Jewish, and she and Arnold basically go to war.
It's a war over validity. That's the heart of Act Three. Arnold is mourning Alan. Ma refuses to recognize that mourning because she refuses to recognize that the relationship was real.
Yeah.
She compares his loss to her losing her husband, Arnold's father,
Yeah.
and just tells him it's not the same.
Oof. That invalidation, that has to be the most painful part for the audience to watch.
It is. And this brings up a really interesting point about how the play handles identity. You're looking at the intersection of Jewish identity and queer identity.
The critic John Simon wrote about this, didn't he? He mentioned the humor.
Yes, in New York Magazine. Simon pointed out that the play uses what he called Jewish melancholic humor and mixes it with homosexual flamboyant humor. But he said Feuerstein does it without ever falling into stereotypes.
Which is a really hard line to walk. You want that cultural specificity without the caricature.
Exactly. And Simon argued that the goal was to create warm empathy. Even Ma, who says these truly horrific homophobic things to her son, isn't painted as a pure villain. She's a mother who is terrified and confused. She represents tradition.
Which actually leads us right into the biggest debate about this play. We have this stack of reviews from the 80s, and the critics can't decide. Is Torch Song Trilogy a radical play, or is it a conservative one?
It sounds absurd to call a play about a drag queen conservative, doesn't it?
Yeah, especially one that opens in a back room and features a guy putting on false eyelashes.
But look at what Arnold wants. That's the argument critics like Jack Kroll made. Kroll pointed out that despite the leather bars and the drag, Arnold's goals are deeply traditional. He wants monogamy. He wants to be a parent. He wants a nice apartment. He wants his mother's approval.
So the vessel is radical, but the contents are traditional.
Precisely. Kroll argued the play affirms these very bourgeois values of family and fidelity. But then you have the other side of that coin. You have to remember the context of the late 70s and early 80s. This was the clone era.
Remind us what that means.
Post-Stonewall, there was a big shift in the gay community toward a hyper-masculine look. You know, the work boots, flannel, mustaches, denim. It was a rejection of the sissy stereotype.
And here comes Arnold.
Exactly. An effeminate, neurotic, torch-singing drag queen. He was the very thing many gay men were trying to distance themselves from. So for Feuerstein to put that character center stage and demand that the audience respect his desire for a family,
yeah.
I mean, that was radical.
So in a way, the act of wanting a boring, normal life was the rebellion itself.
Yes. Demanding access to conservative institutions like marriage and adoption was a radical political act. It challenged the whole idea that gay people belonged only on the margins of society.
The critics didn't all get it right away, though. I'm looking at this review here from Mel Gusso at the New York Times.
Ah, yes. Gusso. He reviewed International Stud when it was just a one act.
Yeah.
And he hated it.
He called it a sincere but sentimentalized view of transvestite extremes, which feels very dismissive.
It is, but... And this is why the trilogy part is so important. When he saw the full four-hour event years later, he completely recanted.
He changed his mind.
Totally. He wrote a new review praising it. He said something like, Arnold's story becomes richer as it unfolds. He realized that without the full journey, from the back room to the nursery to the family apartment, you just couldn't understand the character.
That's a testament to the structure. You needed the time to build that empathy.
And Don Shuey from the Boston Phoenix went even further. He called it gay theater's gift to American drama. He saw that the play wasn't just about gay people in isolation. It was about how gay people and straight people were all trying to figure out the new rules of society.
Let's talk about the production's journey, because it wasn't some overnight success. It didn't start on 45th Street.
Oh, not at all. It was a total grassroots movement. It started in the experimental scene. International Stud opened in 1978 at La Mama, which is legendary for off-Broadway work.
Some downtown, gritty theater.
Very. Then Fugue came out in 79, and eventually a nonprofit called the Glines, which was dedicated to gay culture, they backed Feuerstein and helped combine the three one-acts into this one monster event.
And then it finally hit Broadway in 1982.
At the Little Theater. And yes, it ran for 4 hours.
That is a huge risk for Broadway producers. A four-hour play about a drag queen.
A huge risk that paid off massively. It ran for over 1,200 performances. And then came the awards. The 1983 Tonys were a sweep. Harvey Fierstein won Best Actor. The show won Best Play.
And there was that historic moment during the acceptance speech, right?
Yes. John Glimes, the producer.
Mm-hmm.
When he went up to accept for Best Play on national television, he thanked his lover and co-producer, Larry Lane.
In 1983.
In 1983. It was the first time anyone had acknowledged a same-sex partner in a major awards acceptance speech. It was a huge moment of visibility.
You know, I'm looking at the cast list for a second because the alumni of this show are really surprising.
With a Hall of Fame.
In the original Broadway cast, the role of David, the adopted teenage son, was played by a very young Matthew Broderick.
His Broadway debut. This is before Ferris Bueller, before everything. He was just a kid starting out.
And Ma Bekoff?
Estelle Getty.
You're kidding me. Sophia from the Golden Girls.
The one and only. Before she was Sophia Petrillo, she was creating the role of Ma Bekoff. If you think about it, the character types are so similar. That sharp-tongued, overbearing, but ultimately loving mother figure, she honed that energy in Torque Song.
That is perfect casting. I can just hear her voice saying those lines.
And if you look across the pond, the West End production in 85 starred Anthony Schur as Arnold.
Wow, a real heavy hitter.
Absolutely. Though, interestingly, Schur left the production early, and Feuerstein actually flew to London to replace him.
Imagine seeing the playwright himself step into the role he created.
Schur actually commented on that. He said Feuerstein's performance was just this scenery-eating giant thing, and that it made his own performance feel a bit restrained in comparison.
I can believe it. Feuerstein has that voice, right? It's just so unmistakable.
All like gravel in a blender. It's iconic.
Now, obviously, 4 hours is a long time to sit in the theater, especially today.
Attention spans have changed, for sure. Which explains the 2017 revival. Second Stage Theater did a new version starring Michael Urie as Arnold.
But the script was different.
Feuerstein himself took a red pen to his own work. He cut it down from 4 hours to 2 hours and 45 minutes.
That's a serious haircut.
He tightened things up, took out some of the repetition of the fugue section. They even changed the title. It was just Torch Song. No trilogy.
Sleeker. More digestible for a modern audience, maybe.
Perhaps. But the emotional core was all still there. And Michael Urie got rave reviews for bringing this different, slightly more frantic energy to Arnold.
So, connecting all this to the present day, why does Torch Song Trilogy still matter? I mean, laws have changed, society has changed so much.
The legal landscape has changed, absolutely.
Mm.
But culturally, the impact of this play is just foundational.
Mm.
Pop Matters did a retrospective where they credited Torch Song for laying the groundwork for shows we just take for granted now.
Like what?
Queer as Folk, Will and Grace, even Modern Family. Torch Song was touching on gay marriage and adoption decades before they were mainstream conversations.
It was walking so those shows could run.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
Don Shuey said something really beautiful about the play. He said, it doesn't provide answers. It offers a model of how to come to terms with our common struggle.
A struggle for what?
Self-acceptance. And above all, love.
You know, it really makes you think. We often look for the radical and the loud and the chaotic. But here's a play saying that maybe the most radical act is just building a family.
And that raises the big question for you to think about. We're used to seeing conservative and radical as total opposites.
Mm.
But when you look at Arnold Beckoff, a drag queen, fighting for his mother's respect and his right to be a father, you have to ask, is the so-called conservative desire for a traditional family actually the most radical thing a marginalized character can want?
That is a thought to chew on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Torch Song Trilogy.
A pleasure as always.
We'll catch you on the next one. Keep listening.